This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora and welcome to the Digital Guardian podcast, where we have conversations about keeping our tamariki and young people safer online. I'm Sean Lyons from NetSafe, and in this series, I'll be joined by experts, professionals and academics to talk about navigating digital safety and well-being and how to support your child to be safer online with confidence and connection. Online gaming can feel daunting, mysterious, even intimidating to many parents. Why does it seem so powerful? Why does it cause conflict at home? And how do you know when it's healthy and when it's not? Today, we're taking a closer look inside the world of online gaming. And who better to help us understand that than my guest today, Jonathan Jansen, CEO of NZ Esports Federation. We'll explore what young people are actually gaining from gaming, how modern games are designed, and where money comes into play, and how parents can stay connected without becoming experts. So let's get started. One of the things that we hear from parents a lot is, you know, why does gaming capture my young person's attention so much more than anything else in their day?
I think it's a compounding of a few different things. Number one is that the online space has really become our new backyard. It's become a playground, a digital playground for young people to connect with their friends, to socialize, to be involved in pop culture. I remember when I was a kid, I'd go to primary school, and this will age me exactly. I'd go to school and be like, "Did you watch the latest episode of Brotown?" And we'd talk about what it was that you saw and the jokes and everything else. And that now happens in gaming, where you will go to school, and if you don't know what the latest skin on Fortnite is, or if you haven't seen the latest update in Roblox, then you're almost like culturally disconnected. So it's a very important social fabric of young people's ecosystem to know what to be active in the gaming space. So that's one of the drivers. It's this new social gathering place. But I think why it is so powerful personally is because it is that, but it is also a place that's being designed with capturing attention in mind. It is the new mall, you know, like the malls were attractive because they had the trendy items and the flashy things and the nice smells and everything. That's what gaming is, digitized in your hands on a device in your household. And so some of the smartest people in the world who are working for these giant game developers are building games that trigger our dopamine, that trigger our addictive responses, that make us want more and more, that capture our attention. And this is the same, by the way, for social media or anything online. They're all trying to capture our attention. And so they're psychologically feeding our brain tricks that we love to engage with. But at the same time, it's coupled to this socialization that's so important for young people. And I think you put those two things together and it becomes, you know, pretty obvious for us why it is such a powerful, or why it has such a powerful grip and holds so much importance for young people in their everyday lives. Yeah. That's where they want to be. Yeah.
Do you think there are things that gaming or that the gaming environments do really well that other parts of young people's lives struggle to do?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's something where there is a lot of communication involved. There is a lot of teamwork. There's a lot of strategy. It is something that's a little bit more engaging than scrolling through shorts on social media or just sitting down and watching TV. Like, it's not as passive as people think it is. And that's outside of, you know, problem solving and everything else. It's all completely aside from the social element. I think that can't be understated, is that people play with their friends in real life. They go home from school and they say, "Hey, you know, I'll see you online." They sit down and chat and joke, and that's where they spend this. And I think there is a real value to that social connection that's not necessarily seen when you're just on social media.
I think parents that think about it as sort of killing time, you know, talk about television in that way. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty risky misunderstanding then in that case, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. Don't get me wrong though, like esports and gaming. I'm from New Zealand Esports. We're the national sporting organization for esports specifically. Esports is the competitive side of gaming. There are different versions of gaming. There is your recreational gaming. There are kids who, or Games where you might just sit down, you load it up on the Xbox, you play by yourself there, and you don't get that level of social connection that you do from some games. There are some games that are really passive, and they might be more like kind of watching an interactive movie where you kind of choose the dialogue every now and then. And that is way down there on the passive consumption side of things. But for the most part, like a lot of games are very, very active and very, very, they take a lot of mental capacity just through strategic thinking, quick reflexes, whatever, pick your poison. You could be a sim racer and your reaction times are very, very important. You're memorizing the track or whatever it might be. Even with games like Roblox, where you're running around with your friends in an environment working towards a shared objective. It's definitely not just a waste of time, or just wasting time, killing time, rotting your brain. There's a lot to it for sure.
Are there young people learning skills that they transfer into other aspects beyond gaming
Oh
from what they do in games?
yeah, 100. And on it, like this is, I think is one of the most underrated points of what kids are actually learning. Because we do a national survey every year with a lot of our school kids who play esports as part of their school esports clubs. And 78% of them responded and said that they've learned things in gaming that they've then applied to the real world. And we dug deeper into that and we asked them, like, what kind of things do you learn? And one of the big ones was personal responsibility. There's things which you think is quite random, right? Like, where do they learn personal responsibility? But when you think about the fact that most competitive games that you're playing online, you might be 3 versus 3 or 5 versus 5. Think about it just like a rugby game or a football game, and you might lose the game, and then you go, "Oh man, like my teammate could have done this better, or I could have, just done this." And one of the techniques that is taught all over the internet in terms of getting much better at these particular games is taking personal responsibility for your actions. Like, even though your teammate may have been able to do something better, what could you have done better in a given situation? And the fact that as such, it sounds like a real niche learning point, but the fact that it translated into like over 70% of school kids who are playing esports in schools, and that they're learning personal responsibility, they're learning, on the fly problem solving, reaction speeds, like I said, other sim races, a lot of military drone pilots practice and warm up, on video games, and those skills all transition. And that's not just spatial reasoning or like the mechanical skills, but even just the mental aspect of it. Another one of my favorite ones is emotional resilience is one of the big ones that we see gamers learning and building better. Because I think, I mean, at least my explanation for this is we see the statistics that they're better at it. And my thinking is that, if you're in the rugby field and someone, rucks you a little bit too hard, or they call you a name or whatever, or you feel like you're a bit hard done by, you just make sure the next tackle's a little harder. You get a little bit of your frustration out physically. Where in gaming, this it's impossible. All you have is you have this pent up frustration in your body while you're on a computer, and you have to learn to confront it emotionally rather than exerting it physically. And I think that that's probably one of the elements as to why, we're seeing a larger emotional resilience from people who are gaming. So there are definitely a lot of really, really great skills that come out of it. I could go on and on of what that list is.
So you're talking about mastery, you're talking about progress, about resilience and offline physical skills, reaction time, response time. If somebody was picking these skills up in another context, it feels like that would be really valuable. But for a lot of parents, I don't hear an appreciation of that skill development. Why do you think that is?
I think the worry is purely from sort of a lack of understanding of that space. Gaming has become, as a term, it's almost like a lightning rod for all negative consequence. Like, it's very easy to say, my child's not getting as active as much, or he's not as interested in this, or he's frustrated, and it must be to do with his gaming. And I hear that line, like really, really often. Whereas the reality is, and actually we thought the same thing from all of the anecdotal evidence that we heard from parents, from communities. We're like, man, there's something that's going on here that we need to course correct. And I'll use physical activity as one of them. People think that kids aren't getting as physically active anymore because they're gaming. And so we looked into it, and we did a we work with Sport New Zealand. We did some research, and then we found that the average gamer or esports player in New Zealand are active for 7.8 hours per week on average, which is like that's running gym, sports, team sports, whatever it is. That's 70% higher than the adult average in New Zealand. The average adult is only active for 4 hours a week. The average gamer is active for 7.8 hours. So we found that they were almost twice as active as the regular person. And so that was just like a total myth that that gamers were less active. And so I think it's just really easy to point at things we don't understand and blame it on gaming. But in reality, I don't think a lot of those are the case. But it's totally understandable because I think gaming for a lot of families are almost these dark arts. They're behind the digital veil, and we don't really see what goes on in that space. And so it makes us really nervous. But I do think it's a cognitive bias rather than a reality.
Thank you. I want to talk briefly about money. Not the money you're getting for this, because you're not getting any money for this. But the money side of gaming, because I think that there's a lot of anxiety that sits around this area, be it the money that's being spent, or the money that's being earned. And I think increasingly the sort of the marketplace that exists around games. So not just, it's not just money in, money out. It's not that sort of, I guess, not the view that many parents would have had about the way in which games made money when they were younger. So yeah, a vastly different experience now for games, from how parents would have grown up with them. Can you explain to people that don't understand how monetization has become part of the whole gaming and esports experience?
Yeah, for sure. So, I'll just take a quick step back to set the scene, right? Is that when we created the internet, we almost built this entirely new environment. Like we opened this portal to this big empty field. And this empty field was a place that we can connect with anyone globally. It completely globalized the economy. You can sell products to people no matter where they are and whatever currency you want. And that enabled, a whole lot of new marketplaces and industries. One of those industries, the gaming industry, has really, really benefited from this. And so people think that gaming is like huge, and they say, well, that's because they're selling $100. You go to the store and you buy a game for $100 off the shelf. Last year, the gaming industry produced almost $190 billion in revenue. Now, when we talk about numbers, they get a little bit, it's hard for us to quantify just how big that is. 190 billion. The music industry, all of the Taylor Swift concerts, all of the Spotify sales, everything, that was about 70 billion last year. The box office, all of the cinema, movie, Hollywood genre, area, that they made about 90 something billion last year. So the gaming industry was larger than music, all of music globally, all of movies globally combined. That's just how big gaming revenue is globally. Now, only 3% of that 190 billion was from people buying things off the shelves. The other 97% of that revenue came from microtransactions, from skins, from battle passes, from loot boxes. And if we touch back onto that analogy I used before about like the mall, it's because for someone buying a skin at a game, that's like us buying the Levi's jeans, like it's them putting a it's a fashion statement, it's a status statement, it's a way for them to buy that social currency, and that's what it means for them to do that. And it's so accessible, and it's wrapped around these cognitive traps and wanting limited time sales, all of these sort of marketing techniques that we see stores using, they're doing the same thing in this digital space. The difference is that often our young people are walking through these malls by themselves. And so they don't know that the limited time offer isn't probably only limited time. And so it can be a really enticing place for young people to spend lots of money. Most of that money comes from a few people in the industry. We call them whales. Like most of a game's revenue will come from less than 5% of their user base, and they'll just spend a lot of money because they'll want to collect all the skins, or they'll want to, do something. A free game is often free in the way that they're incentivized to capture your time. And then by investing time in it, you become attached to it. And then you, it's more important for you to buy the cosmetics, etc. But yeah, you'll have a games where that are free to play, but you could spend $10,000 on them if you wanted to get all the, you know, colored stuff and all of the battle passes and all of the access to all of the features, which is a completely new model that did exist before when you put a game on a CD and you bought the whole thing for $70. Now, how much you can spend is kind of limitless. So those people with a lot of money can buy whatever they want, which can be scary as well if your child gets your hand on your credit card, because then their spending limit is whatever your credit card limit is.
Yeah, so when you talk about them all and Levi's jeans, I think a lot of parents would understand when a pair of Levi's jeans are purchased that money goes out and then there's an asset in the hand. That asset is the Levi's jeans. Do you think there's a disconnect in, you know, you talk about skins or battle passes, the purchase of loot boxes? Do you think parents understand what these are? Do you think you see them as assets? Are they assets above and beyond the game itself, or what's the limit to that sort of analogy between an asset in your hand and an asset in the game?
Yeah, I think it's almost a one-to-one. I talk about this like theoretical dimensional rift or portal that you walk through into this new world we created, this digital mall. And I think it's most effective if you think about that exactly as you would the real world. There are assets. There are things you can buy in games. You could buy a keychain, you know, that hangs off your character's backpack in a game. And that keychain is something that your account owns. And you might have bought a $5 pack and it happened to have this keychain in it. And that keychain could really resell on a third party marketplace for $10,000. There are items, there are digital assets as expensive, they get into the hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars depending on how rare they are. So they are absolutely, there are real assets, but there are also consumables. You can go to, just like in a mall where you can buy the, you know, the Prime energy drink and it's like a, you know, really trendy thing, you can buy a battle pass that gives you limited time access to something, or it gives you, and they're consumable. You use them and then they're gone. And so those aren't assets. And just like I believe, you know, you shouldn't send, I wouldn't send my son to the mall, you know, just by himself to go around shopping. I think the only way that we really get a good handle on that and to learn to be able to teach the rules and to look after our young people is to go there with them and to be engaged with it. Like, I think us understanding what's in those malls, what they are, what the games are selling is the only way to get around it. I sort of talk sometimes about how I think we've built a playground for our children to go and play in, and we refuse to go there with them, and then we complain when, you know, they get ripped off and some kid sells them a something bad.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's I mean, another thing to it as well, I suppose, we parents understand generally the concept of rules around things. If you've never set foot in the space, must be really hard to set a rule around battle passes, skins and loot boxes if you have no idea what a loot box is. And you think, I mean, I can imagine rules will be set without that understanding. What do you think happens in those circumstances?
I am so empathetic to parents. I just want to be clear, like, not being at the playground or not being at the mall is not the parents' fault. Like, I'm not saying that they, you know, had the chance to be. It is such an intimidating experience to, we think about the metaverse or the, you know, and it's scary. Like, we don't know what that is. And it's a place where young people are intuitively and they spend so much of their time. And so I don't know about you, but I, you know, going to a party where you don't know anyone, like that's anxiety driving enough. Walking into a whole world where you don't even know the language, it's terrifying. And so it's really understandable that that many people don't know the rules and where and how these worlds operate or the language they speak. And that is hard. You do have to step in, step into it, and you have to be willing to be uncomfortable. I think the nice piece about it is that we can draw parallels, which is why, you know, with the mall example, we know what it's like to feel like you need a certain pair of jeans to feel like you fit in. We know what it's like to, you know, how important that is to win, you know, a football game or a sports game or to do well. And the ways that parents can engage with their young people are still the same. To me, it can be as simple as, you know, sitting down and watching them play their game. If they've got 20 minutes left, instead of popping your head in the door and go, you got 20 minutes before bed. You know, if you sit, hey, can I join you? You know, can I sit down and watch? And that's the same as you showing up to their soccer game on a Saturday morning and watching them play. You know, like they get that same feeling. I don't know if you've ever had your boss looking over your shoulder, watching you on the computer. You know, the eyes are on your screen and they'll know that you're watching them. And that makes a really big difference for feeling like they're involved. Asking questions. There's a few good resources, at least we have on the New Zealand Esports website that we'll share with you about like learning what's actually on the screen, what the UI means, if they're low health, where the high stakes moments are, where you can just be quiet versus encouraging them. And starting to have those conversations around the dinner table are ways you can start to take your first steps into that world. And so it doesn't have to be as scary as it seems, but oh, I absolutely understand that that's how it feels like it's an impossible place to break into sometimes, but it's not.
Now, we talked about motivation before, and it's clear that there are strong motivations towards playing games. There are also, you know, probably unhealthy levels of motivation, if you see what I mean. So I want to talk to you about that. So, you know, gaming can be intense, and not all intense gaming by any means is problematic. But there must be a point, or there could be a point, I guess, for some where that that intense motivation shifts from something healthy, from something that helps build, into something that becomes problematic. First of all, is there a tipping point? If there is a tipping point, what are some of the signs that somebody is moving towards that?
Anything in our world that can be consumed can be overconsumed. We talk about wanting, you know, our kids to be outside more. If your child was outside, you know, from after school till 5 p.m., awesome. If they're outside from after school till 9 p.m., 10 p.m., we've got a problem. What are they doing? and so if you eat broccoli, you know, water, whatever, you can overconsume it. It's and gaming is no different. And so what those signs often look like, I think whether or not it's an acceptable level is up to your household. Something that I like to use as a comparison is, would my son or would my children be gaming more than I'm watching TV? Like that's kind of a nice thing to whether it's acceptable values for my household. But if a gamer is putting, sacrificing other opportunities to socialize in lieu of gaming, if they are losing sleep because of gaming and they're staying up late, if they're pushing aside their day-to-day responsibilities, their homeworks, their chores due to gaming, I think that's when you start to move into that tipping point we talk about. It's really important that we have balance in all things. One of the things that we teach in esports, which is why we really like to get esports into schools, is because students don't really have an opportunity to learn this anywhere else very well. But we teach students immediately about the idea of balance. Like it is, it is important to play a sport. Not just because a physical body gives you a healthy body, gives you a healthy mind, and that makes your game better, but because it's just getting outside, building your nervous system, like just being in the real world is an important thing, and it's about being healthy. Eating well, sleeping well, they're all really important aspects to being a successful, to being better at the games. We use gaming as a little bit of a Trojan horse. Like if you want to be good at esports, you got to eat your veggies and get your sleep in. and it is true and backed by science. But it is just, it's a way to promote balance without feeling like you're just trying to be the fun police. And so, but it is definitely a real thing. If they're avoiding sleep, if they're staying up super late, if they're sleeping in past school times, not seeing friends anymore, not wanting to go out to family activities, you probably got a problem. And the ways that we recommend dealing with them is the way you deal with any overconsumption, you know, set guidelines around it, restrictions. Don't be afraid to say that you've only got a certain amount of game hours per day. We like to promote a family agreement where you'd sit down with your child and say, okay, what games, you know, what do you enjoy playing? How long do you want to play for? Come to an agreed middle time. Make sure it's co-authored rather than just you setting, you know, rules for them specifically. And we also don't like to use time. Instead, we use like number of games because games can vary in time all the time and kids can be sneaky and like sneak in a new game, start a new round. And so it might be, you know, you get two drops in Fortnite, you get two rounds of Fortnite and then it's over. And that might be 30 minutes to an hour. But if you find, if you have a hard stop of 1 hour, they could be halfway through a game, you pull the plug out and then, yeah, good luck with that fight for the rest of the night.
But the screen time seems to be the kind of the clarion cry for control in this space. But you highlight a really good point. It so often backfires. It's that there's a much more, as you explained, there's a much more kind of nuanced picture to what being involved in a game is and what the signals of misuse are. Why do we end up with screen time as the measure and do you think it works?
I think we use screen time as the measure because what we see. It's what we see them doing. We don't discriminate. If they're looking at their screen, often we don't discriminate whether they're on TikTok, like brainlessly scrolling, or if they're on in a game, or if they're on a messenger app, or if they're on social media. Like to us, they're looking at a screen. It's all the same. Which is actually, that's why I like to use TV as a comparison, because like, what's your own screen time? If you can't sit all the time you're watching TV, you know, like our daily screen time is pretty, pretty bad too by our own standards. And so I think it's important to know what's going on the screen, but it's just an easy thing for us to look at. I don't think it's the best metric. The other reason it doesn't work is just because of the nature of how online games are competitive, is that they're not set to a specific time. And so it's kind of like that's why you get these big fights. I have parents who come to me saying, hey, they were late for dinner. I told them to come up and they said, you know, they can't. And then they pulled the internet out. And then all of a sudden, like a firestorm has been unleashed within the house. And that's because sometimes, you know, parents understand. And this is a story, a real life story. Dinner's ready. Didn't come up. Dinner's ready. Didn't come up. Dinner's getting cold. Mom's getting mad. Pulled the internet out. And the son came up and said, Dad, you know, I was in a 5-man team just now. This is like if I was in a rowing boat, like a fours rowing boat, and you've just pulled me out of the boat mid-race. So not only do I don't even care that I've lost, but the three friends that I've left in that boat without a fourth person are now going to hate me because I've just left them on the lurch and you have pulled me out of that world. And when you look at it through that lens of, oh, this wasn't just you watching a movie and you can pause it and come back later, like you're interacting with other people in real time. And again, that links into this whole like digital world space, is that you start to see that maybe it's not how much time we're spending and more about the quality of what we're doing in that space that's important.
It's strange, isn't it? Because parents clearly aren't, in those contexts, parents aren't anti-gaming because their young people are playing those games in the first place, but they are, you know, tired of fighting about it. So the solutions become simple solutions to complex problems to some degree, doesn't it? The pulling a pin, pulling a wire out of the wall seems like the quickest way to get there. But they so often backfire that the hard limits don't seem to work so well. What is it parents should be doing that they're not doing?
I think this leans a little bit more into overconsumption, because I think in an average household, if you made a rule that said, if you made a gaming agreement with your children that said, hey, you can play one round after school, but it has to be after your homework and before dinner. You have to be done before 5:30 because dinner's at around 6, you know, give it a little bit of a buffer time. And then we said that, hey, internet also turns off at 10 p.m. And that's making sure that you're not secretly in your room watching videos, TikTok or whatever, or playing games. That's probably actually pretty reasonable and going to be pretty effective for controlling the household flow and access to that. But when you get into overconsumption, the reason this doesn't work is because gaming and all, again, I say gaming as the lightning rod because it's familiar, but I want to just emphasize that this is for social media and everything else we consume online as well, is that it's highly optimized to grip our monkey brains and to make us want to consume. And so when you take something away, and you get this really reactive response, I think the first question that we should be asking ourselves is, what did I just take away from this person? It wasn't just the device that they're mad about. It might be escapism. It might be fulfillment. It might be competence. A lot of people love esports specifically because it's one of the only places they feel competent and fulfilled, like that they're valued. And we should be asking, what are they getting from these games that are so valuable? And how do I reproduce that in other areas of our lives? And that can probably be one of the greatest ways to restore balance to someone who's fallen too far down that slope.
You paint a really good picture of of what it is that young people build and get from these game environments. And you mentioned right at the start, and again, that sort of the design patterns that are within games that are there to grab attention, to maintain attention, to maintain interaction with games. What do you think, if there was one thing that you could ask parents to try and explain to kids about those patterns, those mechanisms, the way in which games are designed, established, run, one thing that you could get over to young people, what would it be?
I think there's a new field of emerging sort of research in neuroscience around the fact that our willpower is connected to like a physical part of our brain. And that the more we exercise willpower, the better we become at using that muscle. The very core of a game being built, the very first thing anyone sits down who's designing a game thinks about is what is the core game loop? And a loop is meant to be replayed and replayed, and it's meant to be infinite. And the more attractive your game loop, the more enticing it is, and the more you blur the line between the start and the end of that game loop, the more addictive it becomes. So what I would encourage parents to teach to their children or anyone who's gaming is that to identify that moment where you go, oh, just one more game, I'll just do one more, and to exercise stopping there because the game will still be there tomorrow. And any technique that you can use to break that game loop is the most powerful tool to allowing you to moderate your consumption and to restore that balance in your life. So yeah, and usually these things, I'm guilty to it as well. You play a game and you're frustrated and all you want to do is get a win, and then something wrong happens and you lose the game and you go, oh, just run one more. That's the biggest trap, and that's where I think a lot of the overconsumption happens. And so yeah, games are game loops. They're trying to make you do it over and over again, which is why I sort of say, if you're going to put a hard stop in, don't use time. Use it at the end of the loop. When the game finishes, break the loop. If you can intervene at that stage, where it feels more natural, it's least harmful, then I think you're onto a winner there. But yeah, that'd be my advice.
Someone told me a little while ago, I'm a child of the 70s, so television is my poison. And somebody told me recently that I need to stop watching episodes of television like 5 minutes into the next episode. That way I won't feel quite as motivated to immediately watch. If I stop there, I can come back. I'm not going to stop at a hanging point. I'm not going to think I've got to watch an entire another episode. Somehow I'm going to break the loop. And it sounds like it's probably a similar psychology being employed across both, right?
It is. It's exactly the same thing. Those cliffhangers where it's like, ah,
Yeah.
and then you have to next time on, Neighbors. And so that's when you have to do that. And that's exactly the same thing happens in games, except they're infinite. Like imagine there are no end to these episodes. And so you just need to you need to learn to stop, at a certain time, or in the loop. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes. But that helps us get off games earlier, sleep more. I think that'd be a good point. But I also, now that I'm thinking more about it, I'd want to reiterate as well is the other thing this isn't something for parents to teach their kids, but for parents to look into themselves is to really think about the reasons why they're gaming. Finding what they're getting out of gaming that they're not getting in their regular day-to-day physical lives is an important sort of insight that parents should have. And so, because we do see, kids who are trying to escape their real lives, or kids who feel like they're not competent or fulfilled in their real lives, are the ones who are most at risk. And they're the ones who it becomes so easy to do that game loop, because you go to get to the end and you go, oh, I don't even really want to play another one, but what else do I have to do? You know, go back to, you know, just being bullied, or, you know, not having any friends, or, you know, whatever it might be. And so that it makes it so easy for them to restart that loop, and then they're there for forever.
What one thing I think that's constant across so many, you know, online safety issues generally, there's the importance of how connected parents are, and you've made that point yourself. How important parents are how important it is that parents are connected to what it is their young people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also talked about the sort of the fear is probably too strong a word, but that kind of slight creeping feeling of panic when parents think about engaging with an environment that to them might be entirely foreign. You know, this might well be holidays in countries where the signs at the airport aren't written, you know, aren't even written in a character that you can understand, right? It's that level of fear for some people. How is it? How can parents make sure they remain connected without needing to necessarily understand everything that's going on? You don't have to be an expert, I'm guessing, but the connection is so important.
Yeah, you absolutely don't have to be an expert. You don't have to, you know, speak their language perfectly. You don't have to get all the memes. I think there is some simple things like learning the UI, watching the games occasionally, asking questions about it like it is a football match. You know, did you win the game? You know, how'd it go? What do you think you could do better? You know, prompting some of that self-reflection, and just to make it feel like, create some positive experiences around gaming. Often our experiences around gaming are, for so many kids, I hear, oh, I get the groans or the sighs from my mom whenever she sees me gaming. That's a negative. That sinks in, you know, or it's a get off. You need to get off soon. Like, it's all very, any interactions I have while I'm gaming are negative, and therefore it's just like, it becomes a real big trigger point. Build some positive interactions into them by being involved and engaged. And so I do think there are simple steps, although I do also want to preface, I don't think that, it is going to be a little bit hard, and change only occurs when the pain of keeping things the same, you know, is greater than the pain of change. We don't want to change and be uncomfortable. And so there's a point at which parents, if it's getting bad enough, you have to tackle this uncomfortability. Otherwise, it's not going to change. And it's nowhere near as bad as you think it is. It's kind of like jumping into a pool, right? So it's so cold and freezing, and you want to tip your toes in, and it's like, oh, but if you dive in, you get a little shock to your system initially, and then you're sweet as. Or if you will go to a new place, a new gym, a new whatever, you know, it is going to be uncomfortable. And there's no way that you can sit back and be like, yeah, I'm going to fix this problem and be comfortable the whole time and not have to worry. If you want to put change, if you want this to be worth it, you have to engage. And it's not as hard as you think it is. It's not as scary as you think it is, but there is some work that needs to be done. And I think sitting back and trying to figure out a way to do it easily and comfortably is just not realistic.
Excellent. Hey, look, I've got a couple of really quick questions I want to ask you. One, before we close, if there was one myth about gaming that you wish parents could let go of, what would it be?
Oh, that it's an antisocial activity. Oh, that drives me nuts is that, you know, oh, they're in their room and they're gaming and they're not seeing their friends. Like, it is the most social place for people. We talked about them all, but like, I have millions of other stories about, one of the favorite ones I'll share really, really quick is Rowan Crothers. He's an Australian resident who has cerebral palsy. Looked like an alien in the classroom, is his own words. He talked about how he was isolated and alienated and he didn't have any friends. People wouldn't even talk to him just because he looked funny, talked funny. And then he met some friends online. He queued up with them in one of the online games, and then they saw him for like a whole different person. He walked through that portal into the online world, and all of his like physical ailments and differences sort of disappeared. And they realized he was like funny, and he was really good at the game, and he would help them win. You know, he'd be the star player. And he built a bunch of friends from that. And then those friends helped him. One of them played or was on the swimming team and encouraged him to do swimming. So he starts doing swimming with his friend, which is, again, by the way, like a really common thing we see is that gaming can and those social connections link into physical sports, because physical sports are also just a social construct. They're things we like to do socially. And then Rowan Crothers goes on to be a double gold medal Paralympic for Australia. And so he's, you know, the top of his field physically, and he's also a semi-pro esports player as well. And so the fact that it's antisocial is just the biggest myth. And just because you're in your room by yourself doesn't mean that they are by themselves, which is a great blessing and a curse if not monitored as well.
And look, one last thing. If there was a small shift, we've been asking all our guests this, if there was a small shift that parents could try this week that could change the tone around gaming, change that frustrating feeling, what would that be?
Ask a positive question at the dinner table. Just ask one quick, if you know, and if you don't know what that question is, how did your game go? Did you learn anything? What could you have done better? There's some starters for you. Just, it can be as simple as any other sport you might, or any other activity your child might be doing. Just ask them how their game was going while they're not on the game. And if that's too confronting for you, then my second would be sit down and ask if you can watch them play. You don't need to know what's going on. It's just like you can just sit back and, you know, watch the TV screen flash while they're doing whatever they're doing. But ask if you can ask to be invited into that space and just sit there quietly and watch. And I think that would make a big difference for some young people too.
Jonathan, thank you for your time. This has been an exceptionally enlightening conversation. I really appreciate it. That wraps up another Digital Guardian podcast. My final thoughts, online gaming isn't going away. And for many young people, it's not just a hobby. It's social, creative, and meaningful. The goal isn't to panic or pull the plug. It's to understand the space, stay connected, and guide young people towards balance. If you'd like practical support navigating gaming, screen use, and digital well-being in your family, the NetSafe Digital Guardian Guide offers tools and conversation starters to help you feel confident and informed. So jump online and head to digitalguardian.guide. You don't have to navigate this alone. NetSafe has supported people across New Zealand to have safe and positive online experiences for over 25 years. You can contact our helpline for free, confidential advice and support on any online issue you or your whānau may be experiencing. Call 0508 638 723, text NetSafe to 4282, email help@netsafe.org.nz, or contact us via our website, netsafe.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.